Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
Good afternoon, good morning, good evening, wherever you are in the world. I am Russell Tovey.
And I'm Robert Diamant.
And this is Talk Art.
Welcome to Talk Art.
How are you today, Rob?
Today, Russell, I am feeling monumental. And I'm actually very specifically feeling like a giant, monumental, ceramic tap.
Right.
Because I have been lying in bed for the past week post Frieze Art Fair with COVID, and it got me thinking about domestic interiors. And today's guest today's guest has made in the past the most amazing giant, which looks like ceramic, it might be bronze actually, but it's a giant tap. And it got me thinking about you and me and our unrelenting, unstoppable passion for art, and a bit like how ideas can turn taps on in your mind and it can flow and it never stops. It's just like the most wonderful positive energy coming
through
that
tap. Also, if you had COVID,
tap.
A tap could be like a dripping nose.
It's true, my love. It does represent many things. And also, I've just got into thinking all about different interiors because I've been installing different rooms while I had COVID in my house. And I got thinking about the psychic energy that is within objects and almost like talisman and kind of your past life and people you've loved or people that have died or people that are even still in your life, such as Russell Tovey, who gives me things sometimes that I have, like artworks. And just the kind of energy that even within a lamp, like the story of where it came from and the kind of journey of like a table and why I chose that table and all of these things. And that is a kind of very ridiculous link to today's guest, because today's guest makes work that is often focused on domestic interiors and is about to be part of the most extraordinary group show at the South Bank Centre at Hayward Gallery called Strange Clay Ceramics in Contemporary Art. And whilst he doesn't only work in ceramics, I did mention he works in bronze and even painting and different materials, his work in this show is obviously going to be clay, and it very much focuses on the domestic world, but there's something quite fantastical, quite surreal in a way to the way the work is presented. Our American listeners will probably know him because of the Whitney Biennial, but also because of San Francisco and Jessica Silverman Gallery, who I have great respect for. She's an amazing gallerist.
Agreed.
And he grew up in Miami, and I think we have lots to talk about. We're going to have lots in common. So we would like to welcome to Talk Art Woody Day Othello. Hi, Woody.
Hey, how's it going?
Good. How
Thank
are you?
You for that wonderful introduction. I feel like I might not need to say anything else because you hit everything right on the nose. But we could dive in a little bit deeper. Thank you guys for having me. Excited to be here.
Where are we talking to you two from today? Are you in London yet?
I just got into London this morning, so I'm a little bit jet lagged, but I am hyped up off of a cup of espresso, so I feel energized. I'm awake. I took a little nap, and I feel like I'm here officially.
Do you know London well? Have you spent any time there before?
No, this is my first time driving into London, so everything's kind of like super fresh and super new. I definitely feel like a tourist around here. I'm just like not even looking at where I'm walking. I'm just looking up and around and just digesting the kind of like the environment and the texture of being out here. It feels very different from the States. Yeah, there's just a different kind of like fabric here that is super new to me and super new to my body. So it's a little bit of a trip, but I'm excited to spend a couple of days here. And I'm excited to be a part of this group show as well.
What an incredible thing. Your first time in London, you're going to be part of an institutional group show. That's the way to kind of visit a country, isn't it?
I mean, that's how I travel. I mean, I hardly ever do things for like vacation. I'm often like traveling now because my work is being exhibited in different places. So it's a super like awesome like privilege and opportunity to be able to see the world, but to also be able to like make artwork. And that is the way that is like opening up doors for me to be able to see different spaces and different cities and different countries. So
do you have a wish list in London? Because I know that you are an artist yourself, but you are an art fan and you go and see exhibitions and you visit museums. Are there ones in London that you have on your list as musts?
I feel like one of the only things on my list is like the Tate Modern. Like I always see like documentaries and like videos from like online. So I kind of want to just like be in the building in that space. I'm of course super excited to be in this group exhibition at the Hayward and just to be amongst like an incredible list of artists. I feel super flattered to even be a part of this group show because it seems like this is a very kind of like I don't know, it's just a very expansive survey on contemporary ceramics, and I'm just like beyond words to be a part of that conversation. It feels kind of surreal. I've been having to pinch myself a little bit.
You know, thinking about jet lag, which my colleague Carl Friedman always says doesn't exist, and it really annoys me because it does exist, but he's like, it's a choice, which I just think is so surreal. I don't know how he does it, but he never gets jet lag. There's a theme in your work, like a recurring motif, which I was really interested in, which is the clock. And often like the numbers on the clock might melt or you know, disappear or fall to the bottom of the clock. They're just out of order.
Yeah, sometimes they're out of order. Sometimes they're like backwards or in reverse. But you know, the clock and like, you know, this thing about time, I feel like that's the most relative thing that we all share. So I feel like the clocks to me have this kind of like existential tone to it. It's just like, you know, unfortunately, or maybe fortunately, we don't live forever. And I think the clocks in my work is a constant reminder of that like aspect of like, you know, what is your intention with your time? How are you spending your time? And by reconfiguring them in these different like ways, I think it just like reflects, I hope that it changes when you look at it, just like shifts the way that you think about it a little bit. You know, I feel like there are clocks that I've made that have the numbers all dispersed or like all out of order. And I feel like, you know, time can be very disorienting like that, where it moves fast, it moves slow. I know you have COVID right now. And I know, you know, when you're locked inside, time feels a little bit different
Yeah,
sometimes things like move super slow, but they feel super fast at the same time. I think like there's just a lot of relation with those objects. It's like very common. I think it's like an access point that anybody from any demographic or any background could kind of like hop into and have like their own association as to what like their relationship with that object is.
Mm. Yeah. Rob was saying in the intro that he finds your works surreal. That's his relationship to him. But for me, they feel nostalgic for my childhood watching cartoons. Now, you were born in 91. I was born in 81. I was a 90s Nickelodeon cartoon boy. I'd be watching Rocko's Modern Life. I'd be watching Rugrats. I'd be watching Ren and Stimpy. I look at your work and I feel like these are props in some ways that have been taken from these cartoons at points. Was cartoons as a kid and even now animation something that has inspired the shapes and the colors that you are drawn to?
You know, I think that stuff, like the cartoons, is like kind of like floating around in my subconscious. But, you know, I feel like the kind of rendering of the objects and the drawings, like I'm not somebody who works from like observation. I'm not somebody who like looks at an object and recreates it. I kind of just like sit down and I just start sculpting the thing, whether it's based off of a drawing that I've made or a drawing that I've rendered. So I think that kind of like stylization and kind of like the kind of like transformation of the objects comes from, you know, not necessarily like looking at the thing in front of me while I'm sculpting it, while I'm drawing it, while I'm painting it. It's just like I sit down and I kind of just like re-envision the object as however it comes out when I'm like working it with my hands. But, you know, I grew up watching, I'm like of that Nickelodeon like era. I'm of that kind of like generation. But like, I think a lot of like the artwork that has like really inspired me has like that kind of like illustrative quality to it. You know, I feel like earlier on in like my undergraduate studies, I was like really enamored with Trenton Doyle Hancock, Barry McGee, you know, Philip Guston has all these have like these like kind of like Layla Ali. They have like this like illustrative kind of like quality to them. And that was like a point of access and a point of like kind of like, you know, just like relation for me. So I think just like absorbing that stuff and in combination with like just growing up, like watching a lot of television, I think all of that stuff is just kind of like situated in my spirit somehow. And it, you know, the way that it comes out, it just comes out like rendered like that. You know, it's something that now I have more kind of like intention with it. But before, it was just like all intuition kind of like flowing out. And then that's like a way that I naturally just like register things like in the world. I remember taking life drawing classes in undergrad, like it was not interesting to me to draw like what I saw. I had a hard time like looking at what I saw and like rendering it. I would always just like take a little peek, but spend most of my time looking down at the paper versus like looking at what was in front of me. So I feel in that sense, like the work could feel like super like just coming out of my own head in a way.
So there was never the pressure, you never put pressure on yourself to draw something exactly. It was always like you took the information in and then you did a Woody on it. And then
exactly. I think that's like just the way that I go about like creating stuff and like, you know, processing stuff. You know, I'm much more interested like what happens when you have that little bit of separation from the thing that you're looking at versus just like making a rendering of that thing. I think there's so much psychic energy that gets translated when you try and absorb something and recall it from memory versus just like looking at the thing and making a copy of it.
Yeah. So you started in painting, didn't you? Your route into art was painting, and then clay was something that you've been quoted as saying, everything changed. When I touched clay, everything made sense.
Yeah.
So, but prior to that, you were expressing yourself through the medium of painting.
Well, not necessarily painting, but like I always like drew. Like I remember drawing in elementary school. I feel like I always used drawing as a way just to cope with like, you know, emotional things going on. Unfortunately, I was like I was bullied a lot when I was a kid. So I feel like, you know, drawing and like kind of creating these universes on paper and on 2D planes, like that I was able to re-envision my space. I was able to re-envision myself in a different light than like what was actually being shined. So I feel like I always had this relationship with communicating, not necessarily through like words or like through like talking and speech, but like just communicating through like drawing and color and like, you know, just using paper. And, you know, I feel like when I was like super, super young, I used to create these whole like little cities and structures out of aluminum foil. Like my mom would not buy me action figures just because she knew that I would have a good time with a roll of aluminum foil. So I feel like, I've always kind of just like used like art as a way to express what was going on internally more so than just like sitting down and having a conversation.
It's quite an existential question, but in some ways, you know, I find this in my life, trauma has inspired creativity. Pain has pushed me somewhere. You know, adversity has made me create. And, you know, you're talking about the experience being bullied, and I had a rough time at points, and Rob had. Do you think that it was an inspiration for the art? Do you think you would have found art as much of a comfort or found art as your kind of thing if you hadn't experienced these things as a kid?
You know, I have no clue. I'm not too sure, but I know, like, you know, when you grow up and you feel like you're a little bit different than like all the other kids around you, like you, where is that space that you're able to kind of like confined in and exist in, you know? And like, you know, for some people it's music, for some people it's like sports and athletics, for some people it's like writing. You know, for me it was just like using drawing and using art as a way to kind of like create like that bit of a safe spot, but also to like externalize all the things going on, because like, you know, I'm one of those people, I feel like it's not healthy just to like have things bottled up. Like they need to come out, you know, they need a place to kind of like exist. And I feel like, you know, it is like a super like cathartic release, like just being able to have something like art to be able to like communicate, you know, not only like, you know, the things that are going on that are not so awesome, but, you know, to express emotions of love and happiness and joy. And like, I think all of those things can exist in an object or exist in a work of art, you know? So I feel like, you know, there are ways to communicate that are not verbal. And like art is one of those nonverbal ways of communicating. And for some of us, it just makes more sense to communicate using art, you know?
I think the reason I was so drawn to your work and why Russell and I were both sort of independently fans of yours was that there's such a visceral nature to your work. Like it's that kind of handmade quality that even when it's a bronze or even when you made the kind of paintings, like there's something so your line, like even in the sculptures, like that's so unique to you. And it got me thinking back to like Klaus Oldenburg, you know, in the 70s and kind of
the soft sculptures and stuff.
Yeah, but the way it was so his at that time, and I feel like your sculptures are so yours. And I love the, you know, that giant yellow fan that you did has a kind of grid in it. There's something so soulful about it, and for me that's such a big kind of big tick in the box. I love a bit of like deep soul art. But I've heard you reference the spirit, the psychic, kind of, you know, other planes maybe, or like deep digging of emotions. Is that something that's there within the work alongside joy or kind of hilarious elements?
I think so. I think that both of them exist together, like these elements of like joy, but also these more like more serious undertones. And like, I think that, you know, it just depends on where you're at, where the viewer at is with like, you know, interacting with the work. You know, to me that yellow fan that I made, that was displayed in Miami or Basel 2019. And I feel like a lot of the times I just work from my intuition. So, you know, we had proposed to make a larger sculpture for the Meridian section and my gallery, Jessica, she approached me. She's like, what would you want to make? And I had no clue what I wanted to make. Just like out of nowhere, I was just like, oh, let me just make a super large fan. But I had been using kind of like fans and AC units and air purifiers and vents to kind of communicate this idea of like our interior spaces being like this anthropomorphic entity. And like, how does air, like how does breath kind of circulate in like this domestic setting? So it kind of made sense to, at least at that point, to kind of continue on with that line. I feel like, you know, I could go a little bit deeper with like, you know, just like that connotation of breath, but that is like life force, that is energy. I was like reading this book, I think it's called Art and Power. It's like a book of African sculpture, and it's about like African sculpture from the Bantu kingdom. And there's this word that I learned in this book called Muhihi, which means wind, for wind, life force, energy, breath, breeze. So I was like enamored with like how an object could kind of like reference these things without referencing these things, right? You know, if you wanted to just be a big ass yellow fan, like that's what that is. But I feel like when you look at the posture of the fan, when you look at how the center is a little bit sunken in, it's a little bit slouched over, it's almost like it's laboring to kind of like function and to kind of work. And I think that kind of communicates just like a spectrum of emotions and a spectrum. It just has that range there. But like, you know, I feel like, you know, it kind of works in contradiction, because you see this super huge cartoony, like this bright yellow thing, and it almost camouflages what is going on in the interior of that sculpture. So I don't know. Yeah,
I think they're loaded in emotion, and what you do is that you think of the home as this living being. You don't take the domestic for granted, and you play into surrealism in the fact that you take an object and you humanize it. And then these objects, and they're normally larger than life, but they hold these human anthropomorphic kind of emotions. You know, like there be the telephones, and you've said that, you know, the anxiety of waiting for a phone call or the anxiety of a phone ringing is harnessed in this. You have these stools which are kind of fatigued. As you said, they're leaning over, but they have this human energy. It's like the stool takes the weight of us when we're tired. So the stool that you've made then has this tired, fatigued energy in it. It's playing with these things. It's so intelligent in some ways, but it's disarming because what you're seeing is a big yellow fan, for example. You know, you're seeing, and it's kind of cartoony and bright and joyful and humorous. But through humor, you're able to access more kind of emotional experiences and a human experience, because the domestic interior is what we're all experiencing on a daily basis.
Yeah. I feel like, you know, the home just kind of like holds a lot of psychic energy. And like, Robert, you're saying like you're at home right now with like COVID. I know for me, when I'm sick, one of the things I like to do with my space is cleanse the space, right? So I'll cleanse the space. I'll wash all of my my bedding, because I don't like it. I would almost wash it like I'd wash it numerous times until I recover from whatever sickness, because like the sheets hold on to everything. Like I feel like the room holds on to the energy of whatever you're feeling. So it kind of just made sense. Like, you know, growing up, like I didn't spend like so much time outside. I was just like, you know, an indoor kid, and I watch like a lot of like TV. So I feel like, you know, for me, I'm just like accustomed to like looking at these things as more than just like what they are, but like as like these extensions of what is going on internally with ourselves. You know, I feel like, you know, I feel like you think about hoarders, or you think about people who live, like if you're depressed, like you might not want to like open up your blinds. I feel like there's so many ways that like our interior spaces and how we interact with them kind of like it's very telling as to what our emotional psychological states are. And I feel like you know, objects, like we don't just like live amongst them, we live with them, you know. Things hold memories, things hold energy, like, you know. So I feel like, you know, the shoes could like bring you back to a memory. Like I feel like a chair could bring you back to a memory. Like, so I feel like there is a lot of potential for like objects to communicate a lot of the things that humans communicate. So I feel like, you know, there's like a little bit of a transition for me in my work, because I used to make a lot of like figures, just like straight up figurative work. But then somewhere along the line, when I was in graduate school, I got bored because for me in my practice, the figure became too easy to read. So I was like, I started to think about what happens if I took the figure out and replaced it with things that surrounded the figure. And that's how I kind of started on this whole kind of like interior domestic space, and kind of like humanizing a lot of these everyday objects. But objects are also like to me, like hella metaphorical. Like, you know, a door is not just a door. A door is like an opportunity for something new, like changing your space, changing your scenery. Like the light switches are just like a very simple way of like adding light to your day. And like, what does light signify? You know, light being seen, being visible, being cleansed, you know, even with like the water faucets, I feel like that those things hold, it's a very simple object, but they hold a lot of like metaphorical meaning of like being cleansed, being washed, being a nude. You know, I grew up Catholic, and it's just like, you know, reading the Bible and like John the Baptist and like, you know, being baptized and washed in the water. Like, I feel like all of those things are kind of like connected. But, you know, if you want to see a huge just fountain or a huge like water tap, that's completely fine too. So I think they exist on these planes that, I don't know, just like open it up. Like, I feel like, you know, I feel like at being a little bit nuanced with like the approach, like, I feel like that's something that, at least for me, I'm trying to like hone in on more, a little bit more. It's just like, how can you communicate, you know, or like express a range of emotions without like beating somebody over the head with it?
And I feel like it's a universality of your approach to your work. And I've read that you think about your family seeing the work. It's like when we make this podcast, my mum listens to every episode, so does Rob's mum. And when they text us and go, that was a good episode, I'm like, oh, we've won, because that's who we're making it for. And it feels like you're making work for your family, and these domestic universal objects are communicating on such a wider level because we can all connect to them, but yet you've got, they're coded and they're full of messaging.
Yeah, I think accessibility is like really important to me. And that's just like my personal history, because I didn't grow up like looking at art. I feel like my kind of like knowledge of like art history and contemporary art is like still a little bit limited. Like, I don't know as much as like I feel like I should know. Like, there's so many times where I'm having conversation with people and they're like dropping all these names and I'm just like, who is that? Can you show me who is that? I don't know who that is. Oh, what is this work? So it's just like, there's just like so much out there. I feel like for me, like I just, you know, not growing up, like going to museums and whatnot, it just kind of like makes sense to make things that have a broader access point and not things that just reference art history. You know, like, I feel like it's important just to, like, at least for me, to reference life and to reference what's going on. And, you know, I mean, that is an objective that, yeah, it's for sure in the artwork. And it's just like, yeah, I want my family, I want my folks to come and see my work and to be able to like have a conversation with me, you know, because like, you know, for me, I'm a little bit more, you know, forthcoming through my artwork and not through like my verbal communication. So if I want to access like deeper conversations, like I might like, you know, just make, show my parents like an object and see how they react to it versus like coming outright and telling them what's going on.
You know, one of the most striking works for me is actually the series that you've done. Well, there's a few I've seen, which are like radiators, we call them in England. I don't know if they're a different name in America, but I know one of them was titled Space Heater. And there's something so tender about those. It kind of reminded me of my grandma back in Wales when I was a kid, having like one of those plug-in of heaters.
Red type thing.
Yeah, kind of. But there was something so strange about seeing a radiator as an artwork. And then obviously it got me thinking slightly about Nick Deshaies, one of our friends, who's actually done an installation at Stuart Shave Gallery a few years ago, where he actually made kind of these very strange fully
sinks,
plumbed in like radiators that actually had it comes with a boiler. It's really cool and it has water running through it, which I also found really tender for different reasons. And I love the idea of them being alive in that sense, actually having the water in them. But can you speak a bit about that tiny body of work, just because it really struck me as this very tender kind of thing. I just loved it.
I don't know, like there is like a tenderness about like being warm, being protected. You know, I feel like those objects kind of get to that idea of being like sheltered and being protected in the colder months. I feel like, you know, growing up in Miami, we didn't have radiators. We had like little AC units and like little box AC units that we would put in the windows and whatnot. And like during the summer, that was like such a moment of like solace, just to like escape the heat and just like plop down in front of like cool air after being outside for however amount of time. You know, I feel like, you know, it's just like almost like saying thanks to like the simple things, or giving gratitude to like the simplest thing. And I think like having warmth or having like air conditioning to protect yourself from the outside elements, like, you know, that kind of like again, like goes into like what type of like emotional space are you accessing when you feel that type of like protection, and where you kind of like, you know, yeah, protected from exterior elements, and you're just like just cozy and just comfortable.
Mm. So Miami was where you were born, but you now live in and work in San Francisco, and there's something about, is that right?
Oakland.
Sorry, yeah. Sorry. across the water from San Francisco. Yeah. You can get to San Francisco quite quickly.
It's super close. Everything is super close.
But
yeah.
There's this history and the lineage of art history with ceramics and the Bay Area and California, and you're now part of that conversation. Why do you think that area has had such an influence on, you know, American ceramicists and artists that work in that medium?
You know, I have no clue. I have no clue. I definitely think like the ceramic history is what brought me out to California. Just, you know, learning about like Viola Fry and like Robert Arneson and Ron Nagel and Ken Price and, you know, all these like legendary ceramic people. And then like when I was like in undergrad, I was going to the ceramic conference called Enseca, and they do a student juried exhibition. And every year when I was like looking at the student jury exhibition, a lot of the artwork that I was like really drawn to was coming out of where I eventually went to graduate school, CCA. So there's something about not only the history, but like the CCA, the program in particular, that was kind of like pulling me towards that area. And then one of my professors in undergrad was just like telling me about Bonnie Seaman. One of my undergraduate professors was telling about Arthur Gonzalez, who was teaching at CCA. And it's like, oh, you two would get along. Like, you should go out to California, because I feel like it would be like the perfect place for you. So I think it was like a combination of both, like that history and like kind of like just like looking at, you know, wanting to pursue a graduate degree that brought me out to California. I didn't really think about, you know, my place and like the history of ceramics at all. I just knew I was just trying to do ceramics a little bit more. But
do you feel like you're part of a gang there now? Of like a Bay Area artist, because Jessica Silverman is your gallerist, and she's embedded in San Francisco. She's like, you know, one of the most important gallerists in the area, and she travels internationally with all of her artists. She's very well respected through her and being in the area. Do you feel like you're part of a conversation or a movement of artists?
I mean, I don't know if there's... I feel like there is. I would say they're living there. I think there's something special happening in the Bay Area. Mm. Like it's just like one of the most beautiful places to like, I feel like to be. Just like, I was never into hiking growing up, but like living out there for the past couple of years and like just getting introduced to hiking and being outside, it does like wonders to kind of like, you know, your mental health and like just like your personal like well-being. Like those like redwood trees hold some type of like mystical power to them, and like some of the views and whatnot, and just like the pace of life there is kind of like perfect, because you have just enough city and just enough nature. So I feel like, you know, personally, it just suits my temperament, you know, and it's like very conducive for like getting into a deep kind of like concentrated place and getting into like a very committed routine with your practice. Like, I feel like, you know, if you want to be distracted in the Bay Area, you can. There are enough things going on, but like, it's definitely a place where I feel like I'm able to focus. And I feel like the community there is like very kind of like tight and like just like sincere and just like sweet and just like low key. Like, I feel like when I'm in the Bay, like, I don't ever really dress up at all. I'm just like in studio clothes and just like
what is your studio clothes, but what is your studio practice? Because you're incredibly prolific, and it feels like, you know, you work well under pressure, and time constraints are a good thing for you. You see them as a positive spin on the work and deadlines, because you're very in demand now, and you are making a lot of work and you're being around. What is your studio practice like?
I don't work on weekends if I don't need to, first of all. I like to enjoy my week. I definitely have like a very balanced approach. Like, I feel like I probably work 10 to 6, 10 to 5, Monday through
Wow, so like
Monday
office job
Friday.
Hours.
Yeah,
you've given
yeah,
yourself.
You know.
Wow.
Exactly. I it's just like I want to make sure I like to exercise before I go into the studio. I like to get like a full night of sleep. I like to go into the studio with like my lunch packed. You know, had breakfast, had a nice little like workout, and just like, so I'm able to show up to the work and like be as respectful to like just the creative process as I can. Like, I don't want to be like tired or like stressed out or like just like all over the place, because like the work holds that energy. And like working with ceramics, it's just like, it feels when you're stressed out, it feels all of that stuff. So it affects your decision making. And then,
can you see work that you've made and see the energy in the work in the world?
Yeah. I can see it. You know, I could like kind of pick up on like where I was at. There's some stuff, like if I was like, you know, not in a good place, I look at the work and I'm just like, oh, I get a little bit triggered. But
wow.
Yeah, you know, I just like right now, it's just like, I really just want to make sure that I'm being as like respectful to the creative process as I can, because it's such a blessing and it's such a privilege to live a creative life, you know, and just like dealing with the deadlines. And
can I ask though, can I just go back on these works that you have released into the world, and they make you feel this like triggered, like through whatever feeling you was having at the time when you made them, is there a thing now where you are trying to edit the works leaving your studio that don't feel like that, or do you celebrate the fact that they these works have come from that as well.
I celebrate it because it's a very honest and genuine place to come from, you know, and like it's a very like genuine thing to put into the work. And like I feel like, you know, having a, for me personally, having an emotional reaction to the work, like the work is doing something, even if it causes and stirs up like, you know, emotions that I don't really want to access, you know, but I have been in that place, you know. It's just like, yeah, you know, it's just like I kind of don't think about, I kind of don't think twice about it. Just like, I just want to get it out of my system and put it out into the world. And I feel like, you know, there is something about like working with like time constraints where it's just like, for me now, it's just like a practice in exercising my intuition and exercising like my trust, you know, with just with myself, because there's something when you're able to make something and you have ample amount of time and you're able to edit and edit and edit and edit. And there's something else where it's just like, you're on a deadline or you're on a tight time crunch where you can't even like think about like, okay, is this what I want to do? It's just like, I have to do this thing. Like it's going to get done. And whatever is happening in the moment, that is what the work is going to be about. And that's something that I have learned to embrace a little bit more. Just, you know, honestly, just like really falling in love with like jazz music and this idea of like improvising and like how beautiful that can be, where it's just like, you know, you have loose notes and you're able to like kind of go and like work with the material in real time versus trying to force the material to do the thing that you want it to do.
But you don't know what it is before you sit down and start sculpting.
It depends, because I have some stuff where I have very like distinctive ideas of what I want to do. Like a lot of the bronze objects, like I have to have a game plan as to like what's going to happen, because there's not flexibility in that process. And I have some ceramic sculptures where I draw the thing and then I end up making it pretty much how I drew it in my sketchbook. But then there is another facet of the studio where it's just like, I don't know what I'm going to go. Or I don't know what I'm doing. And I just start making something and something else happens. But I think like those moments of uncertainty is where the most amount of growth happens, you know, and just making something where it's just like, you don't know what's going to lie at the end of the road. I think there's something that's kind of like beautiful about that process, because you just open yourself up to like whatever the present moment is.
Mom deserves better than a drugstore card. This Mother's Day, surprise her with a truly special personalized card from Moonpig. Add your favorite photos, a heartfelt message, and we'll even mail it for you the same day, all for just $5. From mom to grandma, we have something to celebrate every mom in your life. Every mom deserves a Moonpig card. Get 50% off your first card at Moonpig.com.
Moonpig.com.
I really wanted to talk to you about your Haitian ancestry, because I saw that when you did your show at San Jose Museum of Art back in 2019, I think it was, called Breathing Room, you actually did a talk all about your kind of Haitian roots. And I am really good friends with Maxwell, the singer, and he's also been a previous talk art guest. And he's told me so much about Haiti that it's kind of a place that's like in my heart. And I've also been at a number of fundraisers because of all the natural disasters that have happened there and the, you know, terrible times that have been happening for people who are living there at this time. But I read that you were interested in like folklore and kind of different inspirations from that kind of ancestry.
Yeah, you know, I feel like both of my parents are from Haiti, and growing up Haitian, like I feel like, you know, now living in California, I realize like how special, you know, that just like how special it was, or how special it is to be Haitian. It's just a part of me. It's a part of like every breath that I take. You know, I've never been to Haiti before, but it's just like there. I feel like it's just so much a part of like who I am. I feel like the type of lessons that my parents have taught me, and the type of like, you know, just like different like ways of existing in the world, I feel like is very distinct to just, you know, my folks being from that island. And, you know, there's still some like opacity to me, and I'm like actively trying to like learn more about, you know, the history and like the type of like I'm just like trying to access that space more. It's very kind of like different, you know, not being from Haiti, being first generation American, having like Haitian parents, but then getting all this Western information about what Haiti's quote unquote is. And it's just like trying to like circumnavigate and find like what it means to me in that, you know. And it's just like simple things where it's just like, you know, I grew up super Catholic, but like, you know, I feel like there's certain things that my mom did. I'm just like, you know, this is like Catholicism, but there's something else mixed in here coming from, you know, wherever we were from before Haiti. I think there, I don't know. I just think that I just like internalized so much, and, you know, I don't really have the words to like access it, you know, but yeah, it's just like so much a part of who I am. And I feel like super proud to like have like Haitian blood flowing through my body. You know, I don't know much about like the Haitian Revolution, but I think it's like sick that we kicked Napoleon's ass. Like, I think that is like incredible. But, you know, this is something that I feel like is like more of like a life's work. And I'm still trying to unpack it and understand it. I'm still trying to unpack a lot of things about like, you know, the diaspora and like just learning about things, not so much from like a Western gaze, you know. It's just like more recently, you know, I've been learning about like, you know, these like fantastic African like sculpture traditions, like wood carving and like the Benin bronzes. And, you know, I've been reading a little bit more about the Yoruba religion. And I read this book called New Black Gods, and it's like all about these Yoruba deities. And I'm like, yo, there's this whole mythology on like black gods that I'm now just learning about. Like, this is insane. Like, it's fascinating to me. So it's just like, I'm trying to access that space more of like thinking about like, I don't know, just thinking about that history, not so much through like a fucking colonialist like gaze. Like, I feel like, you know, there's another way to access this history without just like colonization, you know, beating the head out of it. Like, I know that, like, you know, I don't want to like minimize what that is, but like, you know, what does like blackness look like, you know, before colonization? What do those practices look like? What does that religion look like? What does that history look like? This is something that I damn near don't know anything about, and I'm trying to like educate myself on what that looks like.
I think there's it makes me think of the artist Toyin Ejiodatola, who currently has a show up at MoMA SF.
Oh, I saw that show. It's incredible.
So
it's
the fucking Yoruba, you know, teachings, history is definitely something that Toyin is really invested in and looks into, and gods and everything from, you know, that it's, so I can see the link in the inspiration from them stories and from that part of the world and what's coming to you.
Yeah, I feel like, you know, I feel like there are a lot of artists kind of like working in this capacity now of just like, you know, really exploring like these ancestral like stories and like histories, you know, just like coming from a place that's like, it feels like a little bit more, it just feels a little bit different than what the record has been more recently. I feel like there's something new that a lot of artists are trying to like tap into, and it just seems like it's an exciting time of like rediscovery and relearning.
It's not
like
Eurocentric, is it? What art history has been, you know, taught traditionally is very Eurocentric, and the conversation has just blown up now, and it just opens up so many more ways to tell stories and so many things to draw on. It's a very exciting time.
Yeah, I believe so. It just fills me with so much like strength and like pride and just like optimism and just like, you know, just that the narrative is like just like shifting into a different space where there's a lot of reclamation happening and a lot of like, you know, revisiting these histories that were like once erased and like unknown. So all of this stuff is just like this like feels very like new to like my kind of like journey as like a person and like my journey, you know, going through just like growing through life. But like, you know, I feel like I'm becoming very much committed to kind of just like learning these things that, you know, colonization tried to erase, or at least I'm attempting to do so. I hope I'm doing it with like, you know, some grace and just trying to be like as genuine and like honest as possible.
Absolutely. Also, I discovered a residency through research on you, which I didn't know existed, which actually changed your career, I say, or changed the way that you approach your practice. It's a residency at the Kohler Arts Center. Now, Kohler, people might recognize that name because they're a bathroom manufacturer. They make toilets, sinks, you know, shower units and everything. And you were able to go to this residency as a ceramicist, but have access to these gigantic kilns, which was able to open up this monumental sculpture that we're now seeing you work in, and these glazes and these the quality of the actual clay you have access to. That must have been incredible. And this is a residency that I'd never even heard of.
Yeah, so that residency experience was pretty remarkable. Just being it was super laborious. Like those days were like intense because the residency takes place on the factory floor. So it's just like learning how to make molds and like learning this like industrial process of making work. You know, I feel like more so than the actual residency was just the timing of everything that kind of like really like shifted just where I was at in terms of like in my own creative process. When I did that residency, it was like I probably arrived there February of 2020. Mm-hmm. So I was there for a couple of weeks before the pandemic kind of happened. So I spent quarantine. It was kind of like a weird time because, like, you know, I was there for about 6 weeks and then, you know, COVID breaks out and then staying home orders go in and I have to like quarantine in this town in Wisconsin. And I think if anything, like just like having that time just like by myself, like not knowing where the world was going, I don't know, it just like changed the way that, you know, I just like thought about like my relationship with making work. You know, I feel like,
but you weren't able to go into the residency.
No,
so you went all the way there. Yeah. And then you were locked in Wisconsin.
Exactly.
So for how long? For
about 2 months.
Oh no.
Wow.
So yeah, was you able to work at home? Was you doing anything?
I made a lot of drawings and a lot of works on paper. But like, I feel like that early part of the pandemic was kind of like that time really shifted a lot of ways people thought about like how they're spending their time. I feel like that wasn't something only kind of like happening to me. Of course not. I feel like the whole world was kind of like on pause, like readjusting and resituating what was going on and how they wanted to approach like living their lives. So I feel like that was kind of like the most meaningful thing to come out of that space. You know, there are all the technical knowledge that I learned from the residency, but it's just like, yeah, doing the stay at home or shelter in place, like there was a little bit of a emotional roller coaster.
Yeah, of course. I think collectively we've all been through trauma and we're all trying to normalize. With what's going on with the vaccines, everything, we're all trying to normalize sickness, normalize the fact that we've all been through this for the last 2 years and just get on with it. Things are back to normal. They won't be and they can't be. And you got to expect to be kind of moved, shifted somewhere emotionally because of what we've all been through collectively. And I guess that will come out in the work.
Yeah, you know, and it's like this thing too. It's just like you never know when it's going to be your time to like clock out. You know, you never know when it's going to be. You never know what's going to happen with your life. And I think the pandemic definitely like heightened that sense. You know, and I feel like it seems like we got a little bit more used to it now. But that's definitely like a lesson that you know, I'm just like taking with me. It's just like, okay, like, you know, what are the things that are the most meaningful to me? And just like, how do I live with like intention and like positivity and, you know, kind of like move from a place of love and not fear. So
what is success feel like to you? Because you've got a lot of attention on you. You're using the Whitney Biennial. You're now going to be in this huge survey show at a group survey show at the Hayward in London. You're represented by Jessica Silverman, Karma Gallery. You know, people are aware of you and people are collecting you and institutions are paying a lot of interest to you. What does that feel like for you? Is that a positive thing? Is that anxiety inducing? Do you have to put it out of your mind and just get on with the work?
You know, I feel like it's a positive thing, and I feel like very flattered and privileged, you know, to kind of have this like level of like visibility. I think one of the most important things to me is just like making my family proud, like making my friends proud, being respected by like other artists and like my peers. Like, you know, those are the things that kind of like, you know, I hold on to. And it's just like, yeah, like one of the biggest blessings of my life is to be able to like have the ability to make art. And it's just like, I just want to continue to do that. So it's just like, yeah, putting the art first, and, you know, trying to make sure that I'm just like trying to be, yeah, I'm really just trying to be as sincere through my artwork as I possibly can. So those are the things that I kind of like really hold on to. And it's just like, you know, I feel like some of that stuff, like I have to put on pause, like the other stuff, I kind of like keep it out so I could just like focus on the things that I want to do in the studio. And I think that's like also kind of like ties into like this idea of like location and like, you know, really kind of like trying to situate myself in Oakland in a way. It just feels like more cozy, more home. It feels like I could get into like an easy routine. I like having that access of nature. I like just like being able to kind of like focus on the day-to-day things and not like the larger picture stuff. And it's just like, it's as simple as having a good studio day. Having a good studio day feels incredible. Or like,
What is a good studio day then? How does that look?
You just make a little step like that. It's hard to really describe, but there's some sculptures, there's some pieces where they're a little bit problematic and it keeps you up at night and you're just trying to figure it out, and you start to figure it out and like, it just offers something new. It's just like, wow, like, I really like just made that. That looks good. And like, that feels exciting. That feels exciting. I feel like that's probably like one of the most exciting parts. But
isn't that success? If you like your own work, isn't that kind of like success?
Yeah.
Really?
Yeah, that is, you know, and it's just like, you know, those feelings don't last forever, but like, it's always like try to search for that. Those little moments where you have something, you're just like, oh man, that's really just doing something. I don't know what it is, but like, that little bit of excitement is just like that. That is like the world right there. That is like incredible.
You know, we've been mentioning a lot of individual works. You know, we quoted them throughout the episode, but there's also a big part of your work, which is the kind of installation aesthetic. And I really wanted to talk about this approach, because if you think about the Whitney Biennial, the way you presented these different objects all together, and there's also Jessica Silverman's gallery, I know you've had smaller installations where there's maybe like three objects together and they interact with each other. It got me thinking a lot about when I used to do acting in my teenage years, when we did theatre studies, and we used to think a lot about mise-en-scène and kind of like sets, and how a set can kind of influence the way that the actors move through a space, or how the actors are presented on stage at different points. Do you think about these different individual objects almost like characters? Because I love the interactions and the combinations of individual objects, and then how it becomes something so transformative and very, very different in the installation.
Yeah, so I feel like the sculptures, you know, especially like getting ready for an exhibition, like they all speak to each other. Because if I'm working on things, I'm working on multiple things at the same time. And it's just like, if I'm doing something with one sculpture, then I want like the next sculpture to offer something different. So I feel like they're always kind of like in collaboration with each other in that sense, kind of like bouncing off of each other. But, you know, this idea of like, you know, place and really thinking about like the universe and like the kind of like setting that the work exists in is like super important. Just giving the work as much context and having as much agency as possible. You know, I feel like I figured out a while ago that like, I'm not the biggest fan of like just putting stuff on white pedestals. Like, that's not for me.
But yeah, you make the pedestals. That you said these are a happy accident. You know, you make these pedestals, you make these basically these stools that are ceramic or they're bronze. But that was an accident. That is an amazing story.
Yeah. So I feel like, you know, when I was in graduate school, some friends were like approached me about making props for a play. They wanted me to make these ceramic chairs. I'm just like, I don't think that's a good idea. Like, I don't know if you could use a ceramic chair as a prop. Like, it just makes more sense to use wood, you know? So I made these ceramic chairs and they came and tested it out and they were like, clunky and just like heavy, and like I'm like, yeah, I told you it wasn't gonna work. But there's like one like stool that was like the same like diameter as like another sculpture that I was working on, and I just like took that sculpture and put it on the stool, and I was just like, that is it, that is the solution, that is the thing, you know. Just like working in that way is just like you know, I feel like now, like in the studio right now, I'm trying to like expand on what that like vocabulary looks like. So like now the they're not just like bases or things for the sculptures, but they're like, it's a part of the sculpture as well. So like the whole thing is like this like unit. I feel like, you know, the objects that I've been making like have like this wonky kind of like superhuman quality to it. Putting it on something that is super refined just kind of kills that like communication that's happening. So, you know, I'm glad that I figured out like a way to kind of like situate the two, and like now I'm at a point where it's just like expanding a bit more.
But that conversation, you know, is what so many sculptors struggle with. They make the sculpture, and then for it to exist in the world, it has to go on to something, whether it be a tabletop,
like
a plinth.
It's like a curse of the white plinth.
So the consideration then for that is, you know, that can be a real struggle. But you've like switched it up, and you found an absolute like dream combination for showing your work, is that the plinth isn't superfluous. The plinth is part of the dialogue.
Yeah, the thing that it's the whole thing is a sculpture in its entirety.
It's amazing.
But you know, I feel like that comes from just like, you know, this conversation, or like this communication from making drawings and like envisioning spaces and envisioning environments through like painting, like, you know, things just from like having that kind of like practice, it just kind of became, I just kind of excavated that communication from the two dimensional works.
Can I give you some quick fire questions?
Yeah.
So people looking at your work, they will see a lot of body appendages. We'll have ears, eyebrows, hands are a huge thing, lips, eyes. Is there a favorite body part that you kind of default go to?
I love hands. Yes, hands. Yeah.
Why is that? Because it's the artist's hands, or?
It's just, there's so much emotion in hands. There's so many things you could communicate with hands and like hand gestures, I feel like. I don't know. And they're like, for the longest, they were like the most challenging thing for me to draw and sculpt. I remember like in middle school, like trying to draw hands, and there would be like these little like mittens. So it's just like trying to kind of like communicate that or like articulate that a little bit more. But a couple of years ago, I saw the Charles White retrospective at the MoMA, and the Charles White has the best hands. Like there's so much like soul and style and like emotion and attitude in those hands. I'm like, you know, I'm nowhere on that level, but I'm hoping if I could make more hands, I could get to some of that energy, that tap into that like energetical like field. So
yeah. All right, next question. What's your favorite inanimate object in the domestic sense?
Probably a coffee cup, or just like a mug, just like a regular cup.
Very good. What is your default object then? So now you say sometimes you sit down and you let the clay talk to you. Are there objects that come up more regularly than other things?
Probably the clocks, like the clock. Sometimes I have to like kind of like slap myself on the hand and just like, you could do something else.
Stop the clock.
Yeah, stop the clock. Those things are just such like, I don't know, they're just like really, really incredible like objects. And like, I don't know, they're just...
But it's time. Yeah. It's Dali-esque. Yeah. Surrealism. They're just soft watches. Yeah. It's that thing they're kind of molding in. It's the passing of time, sand, whatever you call them, sand timers and everything. It plays into all of that. Who is your favorite comedian?
Man, you know, I'm just going to say Richard Pryor, just because I was watching him the other week and he had me. This is a stand up I probably watched 3 or 4 times. And every time I watch it, it just has me on the floor dying.
Amazing. What is your favorite animal? Because we've recently seen a dog appear in your work, which is really very a big departure from what we've normally seen, where there's been hints of the figure in there, the human. And now we've got a full realized animal.
Yes, because I got a dog during the pandemic, and that dog has changed my life. So I'm going to say my favorite animal is my dog specifically.
I love that. I've got three dogs. Rob's just got two cats. We're all animal people.
Yeah, they're and just they, like incredible.
Oh my God, they hold everything, don't they?
Yeah.
We don't deserve them. They're just amazing.
We do not. They're just so special and just so sweet and just, yeah, they're just so loving, like unconditional. Yeah, my dog has changed my life.
Do you have countries where you want to show work, or institutions where you are on your wish list? Because you've been at the Whitney Museum, which is like the best, and you're now going to be in the Hayward in London, which is the best. Are there places where you have, you know, boxes you want to check?
I would really love to do a show in Haiti. That would be kind of like really incredible. Yeah, that is like the one place I would want to do a show.
So what is the art scene like there?
I have no clue, because like I've never been to Haiti before. I have no clue, to be honest.
Well, hopefully someone from Haiti, from the cultural center there, is listening.
And also, this is the way you travel, so this is good.
Yeah.
You'll
visit
you to
Haiti through art. Yeah.
Yeah, love this. What snacks do you eat in the studio, and what do you listen to music?
A combination of music and a combination of podcasts. And I have an assistant who's working for me right now, and you know, they have a pretty good taste in music, so it's like a huge range. But you know, when I'm in there by myself, I'm probably listening to jazz.
What's in your lunchbox that you make for yourself?
I always almost bring a salad with me to lunch every day, and just different proteins like tuna, chicken, or whatever protein is left over from the night before. And I love pears. Like, pears are just so delicious. It's like they're they're hydrating too. Like, it's like nice because I get the hydration, and like, I don't know.
They're also good for health, because I think they don't make your blood sugars jump as much as like something else.
In Chinese medicine, the pear is used to cool the inner heat. So they prescribe pears as something if you have a lot of, like, I used to have really bad skin when I was a kid, and I went at acupuncture, and she said to me, "You've got a lot of inner heat, eat more pears." And I was like, okay. I don't know if it worked. I don't know if it really worked, but it felt kind of exciting to know that fact.
Like a pear, I love to eat cold pears too. So I put them in the refrigerator, and it's like, it is such a delight. It is such a treat.
I want to try that.
Do you drink coffee, tea, juice?
I go through waves. I feel like it just depends. If I'm drinking coffee every day, I'm on a little bit of a deadline, but like I just go through waves. It just really depends.
Are you when you go into the Hayward, you're in London obviously, and it opens tomorrow night. Are you involved in the curation? Or will you just turn up and see how they've, you know, set out your works?
Well, you know, I was involved with like, you know, the presentation of my work, but I'm excited to see the show as a whole, and just to see the different like artists interacting, like the sculptures and artwork interacting with each other. I think it's going to be exciting. I think it's going to be good. I'm like super pumped just to see like the whole, what they've done with the whole space, and seeing how everything just interacts with one another.
Mm. I
like the idea of the zeitgeist as well, because if one of my artists, Lindsay Mendick, got a solo room in that show, and she's also looking very much at domestic interiors and the psychology of domestic spaces, and I think you'll really resonate with her work as well.
Oh, awesome. Yeah, I'm excited to see.
What are you working towards post the Hayward? What's your next exhibition?
I mean, I don't know. I do know what the next exhibition is, but I'm just kind of like focused on like the studio stuff. Like I just recently got like some like larger pieces of wood and a chainsaw, and I've just been like carving at wood to kind of complicate the bases or the substructures of the sculpture. So I'm just excited to kind of like, you know, have more of a subtractive process in combination with the ceramic. So, you know, I'm just like excited about, you know, carving some wood, and I haven't made a painting this entire year. So I'm excited to go back and just like dedicate some time to making some paintings.
Amazing. Amazing. Well, we're going to get to our final questions now, Woody. This has been phenomenal. Thank you so much for giving us your time when you're jet lagged in London. It's been dreamy. The first question is, if you could do an art heist, you could have any work of art in the world for yourself from anywhere, what would it be and why?
The first person, I would want, like, you know, like a Philip Guston. Mm-hmm. Like, those things are just like like delicious, and they're just like so good. Oh, you know what? Actually, I would want one of the sinks, one of Robert Gober's sinks.
Oh yes. Oh my God, that's so related to your work and the plug holes, and you know, that is the celebration of the domestic, and also the ceramic.
Mm-hmm. I think those might be plaster. I think they're arranged. I think some of them are plaster. I think some of them are like cement. I think some of them are also like cast iron. So I think they range in the material. But I would just want any one of them.
Do you like Duchamp's toilet in some ways? Is that?
Yeah, you know, that's also like, you know, yeah, that's also something that, you know, I have come back to revisit. And, you know, obviously working with like the fountains and whatnot, like that's always something that comes up. But yeah, just like a little nod to the little bit of art history that I that I know.
Yeah, just saying about art history, you said that making is not an individual experience, there's connection and inspiration, and you know that you always think of art history when you're making your work, which is something really wonderful, that you know that you're relating to the lineage of the practice you're working in.
It just makes sense to be aware of the things that have come before you, and like to kind of like, you know, pay homage to things, but to also offer something else, you know? So I feel like there is something about just having some kind of like, you know, knowledge, and I don't know. It's just like, I'm one of those people where I could always be doing more and I could always be learning more. So, yeah.
Same.
I really love your switches as well. And the plugs. They're like some of my favorite things.
We want light switches, Woody. Johnny probably don't do commissions, but me and Rob would love a light switch.
Reminds me also of how much I love Rachel White Reed's 24 switches. Do you remember that piece? Love her. She's so good. Yeah. The other question we ask every guest, Woody, is what is your favorite color?
Right now it's green. Oh. You know, last year it was orange, but like, I've been catching myself wearing all green outfits. It's kind of insane.
Is there a type of green?
Yeah, all just like different shades of green, like a mint green and a forest green, and like I have green shoes that I wear into the studio. I've been wearing a lot of green.
You're eating green pears.
Camouflage. Yeah. Total camouflage.
You're green on the inside.
Yeah. When you go hiking, they'll lose you, won't they? You're wearing all the green. What is the best advice you've ever received when it comes to your art?
You know, there's an artist like Nicholas Lobo who I used to work for, and he just said something like, well, don't do it for money. And like, that was just like incredible. I'm like, yeah, dude, spot on. And then, I recently did a little residency at Cal State Long Beach. And, you know, I met Tony Marsh for the first time, and he's just like a remarkable person. And he told me that, you know, your intuition is like any other muscle. You have to like exercise it and train it. And I was like, that was also like very spot on. Ooh, so those are the two things.
Break that down. Your instincts are a muscle. So how do you work that?
By listening to yourself, listening to your gut, listening to that inner voice. Like that's how I took it as, but I'm like, that is like very real, like intuition, like it's something that you can access if you're used to accessing it a lot more.
I love that. It makes me think of this quote that I read recently that Keith Haring in his diaries wrote. And he was going through a phase when he got really successful doing loads and loads of interviews, and he would end up repeating himself. He says, each and every interview helps me understand more about what I think myself. And it was like it just affirmed in himself his own intuition, his own instinct, his own thoughts and feelings, the more he was able to talk about it and articulate it. And I guess that's what, you know, an art practice is the more that you articulate your practice, the more you are making work, the more you understand your voice, who you are.
Yeah, totally.
I love that. Well, Woody, this has been incredible. We wish you all the luck for the opening. I think I'm in New York right now. I was meant to be there, but the filming's
run
over.
Luckily, I am recovered, and I'm testing negative for the last 3 days. Woo! So I am able to come up to London tomorrow.
Awesome.
And I cannot wait to meet you. So the show opens to the public on the 26th of October, which also happens to be my birthday. So I like their choice of dates. And they did it just for me. And it runs until the 8th of January, 2023. And it's £15 to get in. And free for members, so it's always worth signing up to the Hayward Gallery and being a member there. Thank you so much to the South Bank Centre and the Hayward Gallery curatorial team for connecting us with Woody, because both Russ and I came to your work separately and we love you.
And we're serious. We do want a light switch.
Reach out. we love your light switches. I also love the plugs. They're just so sad. Like the, I don't know what you call them in America, but like the outlets.
The outlets.
I love those works. They're so like sad. And you can follow Woody on Instagram. He's at Woody Othello. And you can also go to Jessica Silverman Gallery in San Francisco and also Karma in New York and learn more at their website.
And maybe someone in London soon. We don't know.
Russell, but I actually have a show up in New York with Karma now. You should go check it out.
I'm going to. Absolutely. Yeah. I can't wait.
You should go tomorrow, Russ, when we're in the Hayward and you can pretend you're with us.
I will.
It'd be really nice.
Yeah. Well, it's not open today on a Monday, sadly, but it's open tomorrow, so I'll get along. But no, it's congratulations. And that's where the dog is, right?
Yeah, that is where the dog is.
Exactly.
And also, Russ, congrats on American Horror Story, which has been very well received in the States. I looked on Twitter and there's lots of love for you and your moustache. I'm very proud of you, my love.
Yeah, I'm proud of my moustache. I didn't think I could ever grow one.
It's all real as well, isn't it?
I thought people would be saying, like, why have they stuck a moustache on him?
But I've seen the first few episodes and I absolutely love it. So congrats.
Thanks, Rob. Thank you. Well, thank you everyone for listening. And
we'll be back very soon.
Cheers, Woody.
Thanks for listening. Bye Woody.
Bye.
You've been listening to Talk Art with Robert Diamond and Russell Tovey.
Follow us on Instagram at Talk Art, where you can view images of all artworks discussed in today's episode, with music by Jack Northover.
Subscribe to Talk Art at Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Acast, or wherever it is that you get your podcasts.
Give us a rating and write us a comment. Thanks for listening.